In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
If you'd like to know why everyone searching for an easy signpost of Canadian identity ends up talking hockey, turn over a $5 bill. There it is. Kids on a pond, skating together. Pure Canadian fun. The game for the game's sake. That scene is an endangered species. Fewer kids than ever are strapping on skates. Those that do, if they show any talent, end up sucked into a world of high-end skills coaches, endless games, traveling for tournaments, and practice drills. And occasionally, they end up with unrelenting coaches screaming behind the bench and furious parents screaming from the stands. So is the game, as our guest today puts it, on the brink? And how did we get here? Can we find a way to reclaim the joy of hockey for Canadian kids and welcome new Canadians to the sport? Who's doing the work out there in small arenas and little towns to make that possible? And how can we make those efforts matter across the country? What's gone wrong with hockey in Canada, and how can we fix it? Because there's still a lot that's right with this game. You just need to know where to look. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Sean Fitzgerald is the senior national writer in Canada for The Athletic. He's also the author of a new book, Before the Lights Go Out, A Season Inside a Game on the Brink. Hey, Sean.
Hello.
Why don't we start with, what's it like being a full-fledged hockey dad in Canada today?
I'm tired. Yeah. I'm so tired. We have an 8-year-old and a 4-year-old. The 8-year-old plays house league hockey, and on top of house league hockey plays select hockey, so here in Toronto. That means that they play house league just like everybody else. It's the entry point. They play games on Saturdays. They practice every second Sunday. And then the select is sort of you try out and you make these teams, and they're kind of like travel teams. So you travel across the city playing other select rosters. And so he's on the ice as of today. Today will be the fifth day in a row he'll be on the ice at least once. Some of those days he was on the ice more than once. Saturday he was on twice. And then our daughter, the future all-time penalty minutes leader for the Canadian Olympic women's team, is in hockey school. So she's on the ice every Saturday afternoon for an hour at East York.
That's a lot of time in rinks.
That is a lot of time in rinks. It's fun. Last night was at an outdoor rink. It was shinny. We had a permit to play at Dieppe Park in Toronto for an hour as the soft snow fell over the backdrop of children's laughter. So it was a very sort of Rock Carrier hockey sweater moment. There are games that can happen on the other side of town, outside of town, at, say, 6:30 on a Tuesday, where you have to get the kid at 3:15, right at the bell, drive, get something to eat, and get him to the rink and get him ready to play.
The scenes you describe are so picturesque and Canadian that I have to ask you, where along that line of becoming a full-fledged hockey dad did you decide you also had to write about how this game is changing at the grassroots level? Because that's what your book focuses on.
Part of it was beginning that journey, just the very first few steps. And the other one was that, you know, I never had that as a kid. So, I mean, I've been around hockey my whole life. Hockey has really sort of been paying half our mortgage for quite some time, reporting about it. But I'd never really gone through the grassroots experience. I'd covered the Leafs. I covered junior hockey, but it's different. I played house league hockey starting at the age of, I think, 13. My parents didn't put me in or allow me to play till I was a teenager. So at that point, you're not really going through the system. So, you know, starting here and getting in right when he was 4 and then 5, starting league play and really getting a sense of the land, of all of the things that have to be navigated, whether it be the costs. We're talking hard capital costs, which is the sticks, the skates, and we've been talking about the costs of that for generations, mm-hmm. since you had no gray hair and I had actual hair. We were young and beautiful once, Jordan. And
you were.
Now I'm just beautiful. But then you go through and you see that, yeah, there's an arms race for 4-year-olds. It's like going on a skating treadmill and having a professional coach go through video of your child's strides to make sure are they maximizing their edge work, of having skills development coaches both for goalies and skaters. Every Wednesday, we're not a special case. Every Wednesday, we have a professional goalie instructor work with our 8-year-old goalie, and we have a professional skills coach come and work on skills, whether it be skating, puck handling, movement, decision-making, with our skaters. And they're not volunteers, and that's every week, and we are absolutely not ahead of a curve with that. And all of these things, going through all of this, really prompted, you know, myself and editor Jordan Ginsburg at McClellan Stewart to really want to take a look at what is the picture of grassroots hockey in Canada at this point in the 21st century.
And the entry point that you chose was the Peterborough Petes. And I guess maybe for people who aren't enmeshed in the hockey lifestyle, first explain what the Petes are and why you chose them as sort of the overarching narrative.
Yeah, it went first to location, that Jordan and I sat down and, you know, tried to figure out where do we want to tell this story. I mean, and to get it out of the way, obviously Friday Night Lights and the work Buzz Bissinger did following the football team in Odessa, Texas, was a huge sort of, not a framework, but an idea. It's been tried lots of times, but this was going to be different. But we still needed to root in the soil somewhere. So we took a look around and we tossed around a bunch of Canadian cities as places where we could base our operation. We looked at, you know, Cole Harbour. They produced a couple players, right? We looked at Saskatoon. We looked at places in Alberta. Guy Lawson for Harpers in the early 90s spent an entire winter in Flin Flon, Manitoba, chronicling the Flin Flon Bombers and how they're sort of enmeshed in that community. So we tossed around northern Manitoba. We came back to somewhere a bit closer to home, Peterborough. And after a bit of preliminary research, you find that Peterborough is a place where I think it was over the previous 12 federal elections that if you won the seat in Peterborough, you formed government in Ottawa.
Really?
And it was even longer provincially, that it's like the last 14 or 15 provincial elections, that if you won Peterborough, you formed government in Queen's Park. And Peterborough was the place where, say, if you wanted to test market a Timbit that might sell in Red Deer or Halifax, like the sour cream sprinkle glaze or whatever, you tried it in Peterborough first. There was, you know, one of the first Olive Gardens in Peterborough. Like,
it's a bellwether.
It really does reflect a lot of the broader Canadian realities. So there's one. And two, it's home to the Peterborough Petes. And the Peterborough Petes are the longest continuously operating franchise in the Ontario Hockey League, that, you know, they've sent so many players to the NHL that they're colloquially known as members of the Peterborough Mafia, that this was once a hub of innovation, not just for junior hockey, but for hockey. Like, Roger Nielsen spent a long time coaching in Peterborough, developed his video, breaking down video, and all of these things were hatched and developed in Peterborough. Scotty Bowman, Chris Pronger, Steve Yzerman. And it really, when you dug down deeper, just made more and more sense to try and mine the Canadian reality as it related to hockey through Peterborough as a Canadian hockey city with an established Canadian hockey team.
Your book chronicles from the very, very grassroots to, as you said, your kids that start at 4 all the way up to the NHL level. Why focus the through line on junior hockey, which is kind of somewhere in the middle? What is it about that culture and that level?
Because in part, because it is in the middle. One of the things that I found fascinating personally was being around junior hockey players that I hadn't, just in my career, I hadn't spent a lot of time around them. So, you know, one of my favorite places to post up at the rink and, you know, not being on a hard deadline, I could sort of loaf around a bit, was outside the home team dressing room at the Peterborough Memorial Center. I wouldn't talk to anybody, just hang up by the wall. Probably looked pretty creepy, but I was just hanging there watching everybody. And, you know, these kids, they go on the ice. And it's the same at the World Juniors. They put on these shoulder pads. They put on the helmets. They put on their biggest game faces. They go out there. Maybe they punch somebody in the face. They hit people. They skate. They move fast. They look like adults. But in that hallway where there's girlfriends, there's relatives, there's mom and dad, sometimes grandma, grandpa. They come out, they're showered, they're in their civilian clothes, they're in their little suits, and they're kids. So, I mean, what was really interesting was that these folks, some of them might only be two or three steps from the NHL, but they're absolutely one or less than one step away from the grassroots. They don't have their driver's license, some of them. A lot of them aren't even eligible to vote yet. But they're sort of in that in-between, that they're still young enough to remember what it was like to go through recent grassroots development, some of these things that we're talking about, the modern changes. But they're also the ones potentially who are going to go to the NHL and influence the game at the highest level. So it seemed like a sweet spot.
Do you remember when you sort of started reporting this book, the first big realization that you had about what was changing in the game?
I mean, it was a bunch of different levels. I mean, the reporting took place over 3 years. And in the beginning, I had, you know, quite a bit of time because I was unemployed. But wasn't so much at the Pete's level, not per se, not at the top. It was in speaking with people at the grassroots level. So, you know, the Hockey Canada is made up of a bunch of different sort of umbrella organizations. One of the big ones is the Ontario Hockey Federation. And from there, it sort of goes down. The flow chart isn't perfect, but you go down to the Greater Toronto Hockey League and then, you know, more than 100 minor hockey associations that make up the GTHL here in the city. And I'd always assumed that Hockey Canada would say something, best practice, an edict, and it would immediately filter down to everybody. That's not how it works. And the system in a lot of ways is broken, that there's not a direct communication, that the people who really implement the programming, the people who drive this game in this country today are not the people we see on the news. It's not Tom Rennie. It's not Hockey Canada necessarily or directly. It's the people who volunteer. It's the people who are at these rinks at 6 a.m. to make sure the boards go up for the little kids in the hockey schools. The people who are volunteering their time and doing their very best for the game with limited resources. And that's one of the things that really caught me off guard, that I guess I expected, you know, Hockey in Canada to maybe move a bit more like a finely tuned machine. When it really is, it's a bunch of disparate groups trying to do what they think is best for the game.
When you say that that means it's broken, what does that mean in reality? What messages don't get through and what does or doesn't happen because of that?
This podcast goes on for 6 or 7 years, correct? We have all this
time.
I'm just going to take a deep breath and just give her. Communication. Hockey Canada, 30 years ago, developed this thing called the IP program, the initiation program. And what it is basically the idea of kids are small, like hot take, kids are small. So why do we have them play hockey on a full sheet of ice? Why we have four-year-olds skating 200 feet, right? It makes no sense.
Yeah.
So what you get there is you get the kid who might have been on skates first or the kid who just gets it first. They skate fast in a straight line. They get the puck, they're gonzo. And you got kids, you know, if I'd started earlier, this probably would have been me. They're like little players on the tabletop hockey board, so they just sort of turn around but never really hit the puck or shoot it or touch it. The goalies can spend entire hours just looking and sort of lying around the ice, right? Like, why do we do that? So decades ago, Hockey Canada said, why don't we make the space age appropriate? So kids 4, 5, and 6, they're not going to play full ice. We're going to divide the ice into thirds, and they're going to play sideboard to sideboard. So at one end of the ice, you'll have the kids who maybe they've been skating since they're a spermatozoa, you know, right out of the chute, they've been skating and they're really good. We'll have them play against kids their skill level. And that's from the blue line in, sideboard to sideboard. So you have two little nets on each hash mark and they play sideboard to sideboard. In the neutral zone, you'll have a water station and you'll have coaches. So the kids who aren't in that one end are working through drills, having water, doing whatever. And at the other end, you have the kids, you know, who maybe are learning to play on their own pace, and you have them playing against people their skill level. So what you have is, you have one, all of these kids are on the ice the whole hour. They're not waiting on the bench. They're playing. They're on the ice the whole time, and there's no score being kept, so the parents aren't banging on the glass. It's kind of like pond hockey, but you get them engaged more. And because it's a smaller area, and this is there's data that backs this up, they touch the puck more. And not just a little bit more, a lot more. The goalies face more shots. And not just a few more shots, a lot more shots. Kids have to move laterally. So that one kid who can skate in a straight line, yeah, they still have an advantage, but they have to move laterally and make quick decisions. Anyway, you see what I'm getting at here. Like, it's great. And as you get older, you know, our son is 8 years old, so they have boards on the red line and you play half. So you have two games going at once and they play half. Again, it's a bigger surface.
But you're adjusting to the skill
level. Adjusting to the skill level and the size. This took 30 years to mandate across Canada, that some jurisdictions adopted it and some didn't. Meanwhile, outside of Canada, the United States adopted this years ago, more than a decade ago, small area games. And what happened there? Well, this guy named Austin Matthews that kind of learned this way, but I mean, whatever, you know, maybe one off. You know, Jack Eichel, all of a sudden, all these Americans are really skilled. And what's up with that? Sweden, Finland adopted the Canadian initiation program idea. So 3 years ago, Hockey Canada said, okay, enough's enough. Like, we're looking at all these other countries developing this top end skill. We're just going to implement it and mandate it. Well, guess what happened? A lot of parents went up in arms and said, you can't tell us how our children are going to play hockey. So in Toronto, because Toronto is the center of everything the rest of Canada hates, and in this instance, that hate is righteous. There were parents that some threatened legal action, saying, no, my kid's playing full ice, go away.
Wait.
Yep.
Legal
not kidding.
Action.
Not kidding. I'm going to sue you. I'm going to get an injunction to say you can't.
Because you're making my kid play half court hockey.
So what many did when they backed away from the legal threat was they pulled their children out of the Hockey Canada umbrella and joined renegade leagues where your 4, 5, 6-year-old can still play full ice hockey outside of Hockey Canada's jurisdiction. So you're basically playing in private leagues just so your child can play full ice. There are parents now who say, I was hugely against this, but now it's the greatest thing ever.
Where does that culture come from that has parents willing to threaten legal action to prevent half-size rinks, et cetera, et cetera? Like, there's something going on here that you're trying to get at that's bigger than any one example you're going to give me.
Adults can mess up anything they touch.
Mm-hmm.
And we do. Adults, whether they realize it or not, hockey has become entertainment. So you go to the rink, you're drinking the coffee that's been filtered through the 10-year-old sweat sock, you know, the Batarina coffee. And you're watching your kid, you know, with your group of friends because, again, you know, at competitive level, for parents, hockey becomes a social activity. And you're watching your kid play a group of other kids and your kid, you know, scores. Your kid scores the winner. Your kid does this. Your kid does that. You cheer and it's entertainment for you. What it is not is what the Canadian ideal is for hockey. When we close our eyes and you think about what is hockey in our national psyche, you probably think of something along the lines of what Roch Carrier wrote in The Hockey Sweater, you know, the little boy from Saint-Justin, Quebec, who gets the Leaf sweater instead of the Canadian sweater. But what's the image of hockey there? The image of hockey is children's laughter, soft snow falling against a backdrop of a game played on a frozen pond.
By themselves.
And if you think about it, the only scene where there's a negative influence in the game is when there's an adult on the ice who sends a little boy off to think about what he's done. Everything else, hockey's just a joy. So what we have is we have the professionalization of the game at the lowest entry point levels, and it only gets worse as they get older. So adults have messed up the system.
One of the reasons we're having this discussion today, and one of the reasons your book was so well-timed, is because of what's going on at the highest levels of hockey now. And to your point earlier, adults can mess up anything. What has that culture that starts way down there delivered at the highest levels of hockey? And is it actually changing? Is there a line between the stories that you're telling today about hockey parents and what we've seen come out over the past couple of weeks in regards to players' treatment by coaches or even the atmosphere of the game changing so that Don Cherry, for instance, no longer has a job?
So, number one, hockey culture is a stubborn beast. The notion of what happens in the dressing room stays in the dressing room is still alive. Coaches, you know, will still wield enormous power over their players because a bad word from a coach can change a trajectory, right? Jordan's not a team guy. Well, Jordan might be going down to play Lindsay in the Tier 2 league. instead of Peter Brown. I'm not saying that happened, but I'm saying that these coaches still wield enormous
power. And that exists at a young age.
Well, I mean, it is. It's hockey is a small world. And coaches talk and people gossip and everybody knows about everybody. So there is still that power dynamic. Now, the things that I witnessed changing, and again, you know, speaking just through the lens of what I saw with the Peets, was that there is an awareness that's changing. There is an awareness of things like rights and what is acceptable and what is not. That, you know, there's a really interesting example that happened late in the season. There's a giant, gregarious, redheaded defenseman named Alex Black. He's from Waterloo. I believe both his parents were teachers. He was late in the season, his final OHL season, and he knew he wasn't going anywhere in the game, and he wanted to be a firefighter, and he was going to go play hockey for 4 years at university and get on with his life. So late in the season, he was an overager, which means he was legal age, generally. He got suspended because he missed curfew. And he missed curfew because of things that you do if you're in your early 20s and, mm-hmm. you know, you're out in the town. He might have had a few adult beverages and missed curfew. Came back, and then very shortly thereafter was suspended again for missing curfew. And, you know, we're getting to the point in the season where this could be the end of his junior hockey career. He could end it on suspension because he's setting a bad example for the team because he missed curfew. Well, suddenly he's back in the uniform one night. And he's back, and his suspension's been lifted. And it could have just been left at that. He's back. It's been lifted. But after the game, when he comes in and he faces, you know, it's a very small media contingent. It was Mike Davies, who was a really good junior hockey sports reporter with the Examiner. I think it was Megan Roy, who was with Chex, the local TV station. And I was lingering in the back lurking like a weirdo, like I always do. He could have left it. Yeah, I missed curfew. It's bad on me. Thanks to the team for having me back. What he did, and again, keeping in mind that what the culture that's been established is what happens in the room stays in the room. What management says to you stays between your ears. He said, look, what happened was this. I wasn't out going for beers. I wasn't out chasing prospective company for that night. I was out because a friend of mine, she called me and she was in distress. And the Peets hold annually a mental health awareness seminar for all players. So if you're feeling bad, if you need help, you need signs to look for, all of these things, the Peets provide this, and it's mandatory. And they go and they sit in a room upstairs and they listen to a mental health professional walk them through some of the beginning stages of things they need to know, like a beginner course. And he said, I had to go. 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. He went to be with her because she was in a moment of distress. He didn't get home till 5:30 in the morning. Billets had called in, but he made sure that she got the help she needed before leaving her side. So when the Peets called him in early that morning and said, you just missed it. Mm-hmm. You missed your curfew again. He was exhausted. He was frayed. He wasn't thinking straight, and he wasn't able to sort of articulate what had just happened. So they thought, well, he was out doing bad things and sent him home. Mm-hmm. And he was crushed because he's like, I did the right thing. Yeah. I know I did the right thing. But he explained this all to us. And that, to me, laid out an awareness that I'm not sure previously you would have found, because there's a freedom in understanding, look, I know I did the right thing. I've been taught what is the right thing, and I'm being punished for it, and that's unjust. And he stood up for himself, and he explained it eloquently, and he articulated it well, and he really shed light on the situation. And I'm not sure 10 years earlier, one, he wouldn't have had the training. So he might not have known what to do if a friend called in the middle of the night. He might have said, no, curfew is more important, but he didn't. And he went out and he did it. And then he felt free enough to explain himself later.
How do stories like that help change the culture at the very earliest level? And can they do it in time? I mean, part of the problems that you articulate is that registration is falling. Fewer kids are playing hockey. The game's not headed in a positive direction in terms of, like, cultural relevance, at least.
I mean, I think the conversations that we're having now about what is and isn't acceptable.
Yeah.
That, you know, coaches have enormous power, but that doesn't give them carte blanche to treat you like garbage. That they have to be held accountable as well. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I mean, there's data to show that negative reinforcement, the things that, I mean, not so long ago, we all celebrated. about the mind games and about the coaches who were hated and the awful things they did just to get results and good for them. Like, that doesn't work anymore. And there's a lot of data on top of the obvious moral ground to say positive reinforcement and motivating your players through that is far more likely to lead to success. So I think, you know, as these conversations evolve and as we really get a sense of, you know, on social media and, you know, in real life, what is and isn't acceptable, I think that will start to change, even hockey. You want to start changing the way hockey looks in Canada. You want to make it reflect the Canadian reality in 2019 and 2020. You have to reach out. That hockey's marketing plan for generations, including for both of us talking here, would have been, hey, Canada, it's cold, it's snowing, it's miserable outside, time to come into the rink, doors are open, get your skates on, let's go. That was their marketing plan. It's like, what the hell else are you going to do? Well, guess what? Like now, you know, even small towns have soccer bubbles where you can play soccer in the winter. Basketball, I mean, you don't need to really go far down there to figure out that the basketball is exploding. You have that. You have not playing sports at all. You have esports. You have YouTube. You have all of these other ways that you can spend your free time as a child now that you don't have to go to the rink. And it's not, we're picking on hockey here. Grassroots participation is challenging across the board. But among those other barriers is, do you feel welcome in the rink? Do you feel like hockey's for you? So this gets back to the marketing, and this gets back to one of the real challenges that, you know, at the local level, Minor Hockey Association volunteers are, they're good people. They're out to do good things for their community, to create an experience for the children in their area. What they are not always is, you know, marketing experts. They're not community outreach specialists. Maybe they're a journalist, or maybe they're working for the local transit authority, or maybe they're bakers or butchers or candlestick makers. Maybe they're not trained in those. So, you know, let's use Peterborough as an example, because I think that the Peets really legitimately are forward thinking in this, that what the Peets have done and what they've now started to make connections with the Minor Hockey Association is with a place called the New Canadian Center. And in Peterborough, if you're moving to Canada and you're settling in Peterborough from, say, Syria or Italy or England or South America or, you know, India, they will help you get set up with your health card. They'll get your children registered for school. They are your first point of contact for getting settled here in Canada. They do amazing work and they're amazing people. What the Peets have done in the past is say, hey, New Canadian Center, here's, you know, 100 tickets. Can you give them out and have some of your clients come in? And like the center couldn't give those tickets away as much as they tried. So what the Peets have done is 3 years ago, something really audacious. Now, keep in mind that back then, I think there were only 8 people working in the front office. The Peets held a citizenship ceremony on the ice before a game against the London Knights. Now, think of the logistics of this. You don't know who's coming. I think there were 50 new Canadians who were being welcomed to the country. You have to have the proper like tablecloth. It has to be the right color. The flag has to be positioned just so. You have to have the right officiant. You have to have enough seats. Oh, my goodness, there's carpet, but this one new Canadian has a walker. What if it gets caught in the carpet? And she goes, you know, bum over tea kettle onto the ice. Oh, my God. All of these things. But they still felt it was important. If only in the beginning as a symbolic act to say, you know, this is our home. You are Canadian. This is our home together. Welcome home. And they had them sit. And a citizenship ceremony is, I don't know if you've had a chance to see them. They're beautiful. They're wonderful, wonderful events. And in the end, it is welcome home. So the Peets did that. And then they followed it up just this year, again, through a partnership with the New Canadian Center, who reached out to their clients directly. And they went around and they gathered up, I think it was 80 to 100 pairs of skates, gloves, sticks, helmets. Like, they went to the lost and found of local rinks. They, you know, went through their storage facilities. They bothered people on their beer league teams. They got gear, called in favors from everywhere, and had kids come in 3 hours before the Peets played a game and skate on the Memorial Center ice. And they had girls from a local AA team come in, and for folks who weren't really steady on their feet, they were there to help them through. And for folks who could skate, they helped them learn how to pass or take their first shot on net or just go around there and laugh and have fun, because guess what? Hockey is fun. So it was through that partnership, through that connection to the community itself, that they created a tether that they hope to repeat later and eventually grow into a bond. between those new communities in Peterborough and the game.
At the end of the day, is that happening in enough places to make you optimistic about the future of the game? I mean, your book calls it a game on the brink.
There are stories that I couldn't get into just by limits of time. There are stories I've heard from folks, say, in the Lower Mainland in BC, where there have been successful connections made. With the South Asian community, the vibrant, growing South Asian community in the Lower Mainland has been connected with the game. There are efforts. Like, again, these volunteers, they're not getting paid for this. They're not. Yeah. Maybe they get a jacket, right? Like, that's at the end of the year. Maybe they have a banquet where they get to go and have a nice meal. But they're in those rinks because they want to be and they want to help out. And they're doing their best. And some of them they're developing great programming on their own, independent of anything, direct help from up above. Like, there are great ideas out there. The challenge is that, again, we're talking about the communication model, about how it's been fractured and all the other issues about, I know the best way to, teach my kid hockey, or I know the way I run my association. The challenge is implementation. So even if you find good solutions, how do you communicate them and how do you implement them?
Thanks for talking to us today about the wide-ranging issues.
I'm just going to keep muttering to myself in the hall as we go on here about all the things that need to change. But thank you very much for having me.
Sean Fitzgerald, author of Before the Lights Go Out, A Season Inside a Game on the Brink. You can get it right now, wherever you get books. You can also get The Big Story wherever you get podcasts, most explicitly at thebigstorypodcast.ca, where you can even search or write to us and let us know what you think. We are also, of course, on Twitter, just like everybody else, at TheBigStoryFPN, and we are at Frequency Pods on Facebook and on Instagram. If you like this podcast, tell your friends to check it out. Give us a rating. Give us a review. We'll owe ya. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.